Moses witnesses the creation, Moses 2. Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, Moses 2:26. Book of Moses, Essay Number 49, by the Book of Mormon Central Team with Jeffrey M. Bradshaw. In this essay, we will discuss the Moses 2 account of the creation of Adam and Eve. We will focus on the interpretation of two difficult phrases in verse 26, let us make man, and in our image, after our likeness. We will show how the Book of Moses and the teachings of the Restored Church of Jesus Christ shed light on the long-standing scholarly controversies about these verses. First, a digression on the most famous painting of the creation of Adam. Of Michelangelo's immortal depiction, De Vecchi eloquently writes, perhaps the best known of the scenes in the Sistine Chapel, the creation of Adam must also have aroused particular admiration among the artist's contemporaries, who discerned in it the materialization of one of the highest ideals of Renaissance culture, the dignity of man, created by God in his own image. The exaltation of the spiritual faculties of man was never separated from that of the beauty of the human body, the mirror of God, and the culmination of the creation. Vasari describes Adam as a figure whose beauty, pose, and contours are such a quality that he seems newly created by his supreme and first creator, rather than by the brush and design of a mere mortal. Seen against an indistinct natural background that is only just hinted at, as if it were the dawn of the world, the youthful, athletic figure, reclining on a grassy slope, almost in the edge of an abyss, seems as if he is about to rise from the ground. He holds out his arm toward that of the Lord, who, borne aloft amidst a flight of angels, or the premortal spirits of humanity, stands out brightly against the shell of shadow of his huge purple mantle. The remarkable invention of the outstretched arm and the forefingers about to meet becomes a metaphor for the vital energy that passes from the Creator to the creature fashioned in his image, awakening his heroic vigor. Adam's adolescent face, seen in profile, still lacking a definite expression, contrasts with the mature, intensely energetic one of the Lord, with his gray hair and long beard streaming in the air. End of quote. Although Adam and the Father are the central figures in this panel, much attention has been given to the beautiful and enigmatic female figure who is intently regarding the creation of the first man, while wrapped in the loving embrace of God's left arm. Her identity has variously been given as the immortal Sophia, wisdom, or as the premortal Eve. Relying on the analysis of the structure of the three Sistine Chapel Adam and Eve panels by art historian Leo Steinberg, Gary A. Anderson observes, quote, just to the right of Eve sits an infant who is also held by God the Father, though this time with just the thumb and index finger. The extension of his fingers corresponds exactly to the way a priest would grasp the Eucharistic wafer. In other words, this child is Mary's boy, the Christ child. Strikingly, he is the only figure on the entire ceiling who looks directly down into the gaze of the viewer. And so our question as we ponder the women in these three panels, are they Eve, the first woman and the spouse of Adam, or Mary, the mother of Jesus and symbol of the church? Or perhaps more accurately, are these women, in truth, both Eve and Mary? End of quote. Anderson concludes that just as Christ is portrayed in Scripture as the second Adam, Mary is being depicted here as the second Eve. A final note about the fresco from the historian of sacred art, Marco Ivan Ripnik. When in 1512, Michelangelo finally completed the fresco on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, one of the best-known paintings of all time, the cardinal supervising the work admired the magnificent fresco for several hours. Afterward, they wanted to meet the master Michelangelo. They reproached him, saying, do it over again. Their dissatisfaction, of course, was not for the work as a whole, but for a seemingly unimportant detail. Michelangelo had drawn the panel of the creation and man with the fingers of God and Adam touching each other. The cardinal said that the fingers should not touch. Indeed, they required not only that the fingers be separated, but also that the finger of God would be fully extended, while the last joint of the finger of Adam would bend back. A simple detail, but with a surprising meaning. God is always there, but it is man who must decide to search for him. If he so desire, he can reach out and touch the finger of God, but otherwise he can spend his whole life without searching. Thus, the last joint of Adam's contracted finger represents free will. End of quote. Let us make man. Readers may wonder whether the reference is only to Adam or to both Adam and Eve. The term man, Hebrew Adam, as it is used in this context, is meant to encompass both man and woman, as shown in verses 27, 28, and Moses 6, 9, where it is construed with plural verbs and terminations. By way of contrast, the use of the Hebrew term ish to mean man in the everyday sense is eventually introduced only after the woman, isha, is created. President Spencer W. Kimball further explained that man, as used here, was not meant to describe, quote, a separate man, but a complete man, which is husband and wife, end of quote. With respect to the us in the phrase, the Book of Moses, unlike Genesis, explicitly identifies the other participant in the discussion as God's only begotten. Notably, both other instances of the use of this plural formula in Genesis involve important decisions about the fate of humanity, the expulsion from Eden, and the dispersal after the destruction of Babel. Despite the fact that Joshua Sachs' Hebrew grammar, which Joseph Smith studied in Kirtland, describes the Hebrew equivalent of the English Elohim as a singular noun with plural form, the prophet came to interpret the term as a plural. The plural form of this expression has long been an interpretive problem for commentators that look at the Old Testament through the lens of strict monotheism. The phrase is often explained by way of analogy to the royal we, used by a king or queen in self-reference. However, this does not explain why it occurs only in the early chapters of Genesis and nowhere else. Moreover, the point of the verse at hand is to show the unique correspondence between God and man, not the majesty of God. A view consistent with Latter-day Saint Scripture is to imagine the setting for the verse as God addressing not only the premortal Jesus Christ, but, in addition, a heavenly council. It is significant, observes Faulkner, that, quote, human creation is not a simple act of God's fiat. Rather, creation is a subject of consideration and discussion. God creates humanity in response to others, rather than as merely an act of self-will. Even in the beginning, there is already relation. There is no absolute beginning, not even in the beginning. Describing this scene, the prophet stated, quote, the head god called together the gods and sat in grand council to bring forth the world, end of quote. Friedman likewise writes, quote, in pagan myth, the chief god, when formally speaking for the council of the gods, speaks in the plural, end of quote. Since for most Christian and Jewish commentators, the idea of a plurality of gods is unacceptable, a court of angels is often imagined in place of a polytheistic council. Though one is forced to admit that the concept of many gods is hinted at elsewhere in the Old Testament. Further describing the composition of a council of gods, Margaret Barker argues that the ancient religion of Israel, prior to alterations by reforming Deuteronomists, clearly distinguished between the Most High God and several sons of God, the chief of which was Yahweh, or Jehovah. She marshals evidence to show that the early Jewish converts to Christianity, who retained shreds of the ancient belief, naturally saw Jesus Christ as the bodily manifestation of Yahweh, the Holy One of Israel. The abrupt change of style between the description of the creation of animals, let the earth bring forth, and that of man, let us make, signals the unique status of man and the woman, created in God's image and likeness, as a pinnacle of the manifestly ascending gradational order of creation. Moreover, the phrasing of Abraham's account, let us go down and form man, so the gods went down to organize man, together with additional detail about the creation of Adam and Eve, provided in Moses 3, makes strikingly clear the increased personal and direct involvement of God in the creation of man. The idea in and of itself does not necessarily conflict with the scientific evidence that seems to rule out the concept of a special creation for the human body. However, as Kent Jackson comments, quote, whatever the process for creating humans may have been, the scriptures are clear in differentiating between the process, that process, and the process by which other life was made, end of quote. In our image, after our likeness. Unlike the earlier creatures who were each made after their kind, man and woman were made in God's image and likeness. The prophet Joseph Smith made it clear that this phrase applied not only to the physical appearance of Adam and Eve, but also to their spiritual nature, which was, in the beginning, quote, innocent, harmless, and spotless, bearing the same image as God's. And when the man fell, he did not lose his image, but only his character, still retaining the image of his Maker. And though through the atonement of Christ and the resurrection and obedience in the gospel, we shall again be conformed to the full image of Jesus Christ, and then we shall have attained to the full image, glory, and character of God. End of quote. About this double movement of image and likeness, Faulkner observes, quote, "Humans begin like God, and at the same time they come to be like Him." End of quote. Notice that these phrases are reversed when the birth of Seth is described in his, Adam's, own likeness, after his own image. End of quote. Moses 6:9 is more specific than 2:26 in saying that man was created, quote, "in the image of his, God's, own body." End of quote. Joseph Smith spoke very plainly about the meaning of these words, quote, "God himself, who sits enthroned in yonder heavens, is a man like unto one of yourselves." That is, the great secret. If the veil were rent today, and you would see him in all the person, image, fashion, and the very form of man, like yourselves. For Adam was a man formed in his likeness, and created in the very fashion and image of God. End of quote. Non-Latter-day Saint scholar Philip Munoa concurs, citing Levison, who concluded that, quote, "the image itself consists of physical similarity to God." End of quote. He recalls the tradition in Genesis Rabbah 8:10 that, quote, "Adam's likeness to God is so exact that Adam must be put to sleep so that the angels might worship the right person." In Yalkut Shimoni 1:20 on Genesis 2:9, the angels exclaim, when they notice Adam's resemblance to God, "Are there two powers in heaven?" Jacob Neusner finds it stunning that the rabbinical commentators took this idea so literally, affirming that even the angels did not know man from God, stating, "I cannot imagine a more daring affirmation of humanity." End of quote. Moses 2:27 equates the image of God to the image of the only begotten. Quote, "In mine own image, in the image of mine only begotten." End of quote. This recalls similar teachings in Philo and the Gnostics that, quote, "the Logos is the shadow or image of God, while the man of Moses 2:26 and 27 is the shadow or image of the Logos, a shadow of a shadow, as it were." End of quote. Conclusion. We close with a statement from the great Hebrew Bible scholar Nahum Sarna, who described the import of the Genesis description of man's creation in the image and likeness of God in terms that will ring true to Latter-day Saints. He comments, quote, "The words used to convey these ideas can be better understood in the light of a phenomenon registered in both Mesopotamia and Egypt, where the ruling monarch is described as the image or the likeness of a god. Without doubt, the terminology employed in Genesis 1:26 is derived from regal vocabulary, which serves to elevate the king above the ordinary run of men. In the Bible, this idea has become democratized. All human beings are created in the image of God. Each person bears the stamp of royalty."